Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. I want to talk about the moments that are what we might call life-changing. In movies, they're always paired with sweeping crescendos and gasps or sighs from those whose life just changed. Outside of films, though, doesn't it seem incredibly rare to be able to point to a specific action instantly changing the course of your life? For example, meeting the person you decide to marry, if you're into that sort of thing. Sure, you can acknowledge that if you never met that person, they wouldn't have gotten to know you, and you wouldn't have fallen in love with them, and then you would have never gotten married to them. But your life changing from how it was before you met to what it is now after you're married took time and many little and big actions since that very first meeting. But sometimes, very rarely, meeting someone once can have huge, instantaneous, and even disastrous effects. The podcast Criminal tells the stories of people who've done wrong, been wronged, or gotten caught somewhere in the middle, covering crimes big and small. In one episode, they follow a truly life-changing moment from beginning to end. Here's Criminal host Phoebe Judge.
So we aren't going to be using the victim's real name in this story. And that's for a couple of different reasons, and we're respecting your wishes on that. Why do you feel so strongly about not using the victim's real name?
The victim in this case endured extraordinary psychological pressure from the defendant for 20 years. He spent all of the 80s and all of the 90s not telling people what was happening to him. There was also a defense proffered in this case that is quite truthfully embarrassing to him. I don't want to talk about that and use his real name. He's got family out there. There were people that worked with him. There are his neighbors.
That had no idea this was going on.
They had no idea. And this man, he deserved none of it.
Stephanie Nally used to be a prosecutor in the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. She worked with special victims who were typically more vulnerable. The young, the elderly, the sexually abused. And back in 2002, just as she was about to leave that unit, she got one more case involving a victim we've agreed to call Robert, who was so polite and so discreet that he unwittingly became the perfect target. I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Criminal. The story starts in the middle of a traffic jam around 1977. Robert was on his way home from work in Southern California. He was in the aeronautics industry, some sort of engineer. Also, he was small. He was maybe 5 feet tall. Stephanie Nally describes him as slight, with an adolescent face, a white man in his late 40s.
He was coming home from work on a highway. It's an east-west artery highway, the 91 freeway, and there was a traffic jam. And he decided to get off the highway and run along a parallel road to try to avert the congestion and then get back on. And when he did, he got off in the city of Compton, California.
In the late 70s, Compton was on its way to becoming the internationally notorious high-crime city, overrun with gang violence. Robert would later say he was scared. He didn't know where he was.
As he wound his way through the streets looking for a way to parallel the freeway and get back on, he accidentally sideswiped a Cadillac that was parked on the side of the street.
He stopped, pulled over, and looked up in his rearview mirror. Robert says a group of boys were running towards him. He didn't know why, and he was terrified. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, his car door opens, the driver's side door, and a guy about 18 years old pushes him over into the passenger seat.
Remember, this is the era of big bench seats and nobody wore seat belts. Slid him over to the passenger seat, jumped in the car, and said, "I'm about to save your life."
It was only a matter of seconds. Robert was completely out of his element and not physically in a position to defend himself.
So he let this man drive him away.
Where did they go?
They just went around the corner. They went to a different part of the neighborhood where it was safe. And the defendant looked over to him and said, "I just saved your life, and that was my mother's car that you hit, and you need to pay for the damages." And Robert said, okay.
Robert gave the guy his name, his phone number, and address, and he told him to please be in touch with an estimate for the car repairs. His name was Leon Moore. The next day he got a call. Moore said he had an estimate. Robert told him to come over.
$4,500.
In 1977. That's like $18,000 in today's money.
And Robert knew that it was excessive. He knew that that was too much money. But he was grateful. He really thought that this boy had saved his life. He thought that he was going to get beat up by the man he saw in the mirror. I don't think the money meant much to him. He lived very simply, and I think he was a fairly well-paid engineer. And he just gave him the money, willingly. And at that point, I think was happy to do so, that first day.
What do you mean that first day? Did it keep going on?
It did.
It's not exactly clear what happened next. What we do know is that Leon Moore didn't just take the car repair money and go on with his life. He came back, asking for more money, not just once, but again and again. In a lot of ways, his request seemed pretty innocent. Maybe it was something to do with school or work. One time he said his mom needed new dentures. And he wasn't asking for much, $100 here, $200 there. Not nothing. But like Nally said, Robert was single, well-paid, and had no kids.
And for a little while, Robert was still grateful to this kid who he thought had saved his life or at least gotten him out of a big pinch. And so he gave the money.
For about 2 years, almost like a favor, thousands of dollars. Then, around 1980, things changed.
Robert came home from work one day, and this apartment complex where he lived had the kind of carport where all the cars park lined up, but there's one covering. So there's a partial view into where you are. And Robert came out to the carport, and Leon was waiting for him, sort of crouched down. And when he got there, he stood up, and he told Robert that his kids had been kidnapped.
And he was down at the in front of the car, sitting down where I couldn't see him.
This is Robert, from an interview he recorded with the police many years later.
So I went directly to my car and unlocked the door and opened it, and I heard this rustling, and he stood up, and he was, you know, like looming over the front of my car.
Okay.
And he had a gun. He confronted me with the gun and told me that his kids are being held hostage because of a drug deal, that if he didn't get the money from me, he was going to kill me.
At that point, everything changed.
Robert gives the $10,000, the gun gets pulled, and still does he go to any authority?
No. He was embarrassed. He was a little ashamed, and at this point, he was the only one being affected, and he quite truthfully just kept hoping it would go away, that it would be the last time.
So as a lawyer, like what are you thinking Robert should have been doing here?
If I could go back in time and tell him what to do, he should have gone to the police. He should have filed an insurance claim. He should have demanded proof that the car belonged to him. There's a lot of should-haves, could-haves along the way. But he didn't. He's not me. He wasn't a lawyer. He was a simple man leading a simple life. And he just wanted it to stop. He wanted it to go away.
It kept going. For the next 6 or 7 years, the demands continued. Robert says the only periods when he wasn't giving Moore any money were when Moore was in prison for other unrelated crimes. And it's around this time that it starts to become clear how sophisticated a con this really is. Things progress from opportunism to outright threats to creating a whole cast of characters for total manipulation.
In 1986, a female contacted the victim Robert and said, this female said that she was the wife of Leon Moore.
And Leon, according to them, had been killed.
And so now Robert had to pay her.
The woman said she was moving to Jackson, Mississippi, and she wanted Robert to send her money while she was there.
And Robert said, no, I'm not going to do that. And then a man got on the phone and said that they had people and were going to kill you unless you give this woman money.
Nobody knows exactly who this man was, but Robert was pretty sure it was not Leon Moore.
And Robert was scared enough that he went once a month for 6 years and got a $400 cashier's check and sent it to a P.O. box in Mississippi. And it turns out during that time that Leon Moore was incarcerated in Mississippi.
So he was paying for God knows what, but something.
Something.
And then Leon reappeared. And that stopped.
By 2002, Robert had been paying off Leon Moore for 25 years. He says he didn't want to get anyone else involved. It's tempting to speculate on Robert's thinking, to say he should have just gone to the cops, moved away. He should have done something. Whatever his reasons, he just didn't. And Leon Moore kept coming.
Did Leon Moore ever say to Robert, give me $10,000 and I'll never contact you again?
Many times. Many, many times.
So he was saying this is the last time.
This is the last time. And of course it wasn't the last time. You and I can see that. And Robert probably knew it on some level, but he just kept hoping. His mother lived right there. You know, there were various threats made. His imagination was going wild. He was scared and embarrassed. And at some point, it had been going on so long that he knew that if he went to the police, he'd look like a fool. And so he just endured it.
Robert kept meticulous records of all these transactions. One time, Leon Moore asked for $2,800 so he could move into a house. When Robert told him no, Moore and his sister showed up at the apartment, yelling and beating on the windows. Robert was worried about causing a scene, so he wrote the check. There are copies of 9 checks and 67 cashier's checks he wrote over the years. Coupled with all the cash he says he withdrew and handed over, it's estimated Robert gave Leon Moore more than $100,000 over the course of 25 years. When Robert finally went to the cops, it's because he thought Moore had killed or was about to kill somebody. In his final letter, Moore asked Robert for $8,000. He said he was going to, quote, do away with his girlfriend and move to Belize. The letter also threatened Robert's family. And for some reason, perhaps because other people were being endangered, Robert finally went to the police. It was November of 2002, and he was 72 years old.
May I ask you some questions about your memory?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to say 3 words, and you say them back after I stop. Pony, quarter, and orange. And what are those words?
Pony, quarter, and orange.
The state was building a case against Leon Moore. Robert was going to be a key witness. In the interview, Robert's funny. He makes jokes about being bad at math. He's remarkably upbeat for someone who's been extorted for the last quarter century. But there are moments when he's trying to make sense of it all himself, recognizing that he probably should have done something about it earlier. He calls himself a coward twice.
I guess maybe I'm a coward. I don't know.
At the end of the interview, he explains to the detective what he wants to have happen.
I just wish it'd go away. I'm not seeking money. If this thing would go away, I'd be happy. I guess if I'd have to put it simply, I'd like him to be in jail till the day I die of natural causes. Yes. And unsuspicious causes.
4 months later, Robert died.
It was about 2 weeks before trial, and I was engaging in trial prep, getting my witnesses together, you know, re-interviewing the officers who responded, lining up the checks, things like that, just getting my witnesses in order. And I got a phone call from the court clerk, and she said, you need to come up here. You need to come up right now. So I did. I walked up and I walked in the courtroom, and it was the court reporter and the court clerk and a man that looked almost exactly like Robert, but taller. And the man had a piece of paper in his hand that was a subpoena. And he turned to me and he said, this subpoena has my brother's name on it. Was he the victim of a crime?
What did you find out?
Robert had never told anyone about what was happening to him. He'd never told his mother. He'd never told his brother. He'd never told anybody what had happened to him, and he had subsequently died. In between the preliminary hearing and the trial, he had died in his bed, in his bedroom. And his brother was cleaning his apartment. They were going through his effects, and they had found the subpoena. And that was the only reason they even knew about it. So I sat down with his brother, and I explained to him, not in every detail, but basically what had happened, and explained that his brother had endured it and had finally come forward when he thought somebody else had been hurt, and explained to him that I was going to keep going.
And what was his brother's response when he heard what Robert had been through for so long?
He was devastated. He was devastated. This man, his brother, was just as sweet as Robert was. They were just two very nice, well-meaning, wonderful citizens. He was devastated and heartbroken.
Does anyone actually know how Robert died?
After I found out that he was dead, I talked to the brother. My first phone call was to the detective, and I went with the crime scene unit, and we immediately went to the apartment. But if it was a crime scene, it was cleaned up. There was the effects were half packed up. The bedding that he was sleeping in was gone. There were no blood or urine samples to be had. The crime scene unit did go over the entire apartment, but there was no evidence.
Is there? Do we know what it says on the death certificate? Those causes?
I never saw the death certificate. I'm sure. An educated guess would say that he died of natural causes.
What did the defense argue?
They put forth the argument that the money had exchanged hands because of sexual favors.
That Robert was paying Leon Moore for sex.
Yes. And it turns out that the victim suffered from a medical condition that made any engagement in those sort of acts impossible.
The jury didn't buy it. Moore was initially convicted on 2 counts of fraud against an elder and 1 count of sending a threatening letter for the purpose of extortion. For various technical reasons, only the letter conviction ended up sticking, and Leon Moore was sentenced to 8 years in prison. The last time he appeared in the California prison system was in 2013, a 3-hour misdemeanor stint. The interview Robert recorded, the one you've been hearing throughout this story, turned out to be a key factor in the trial. California law allows such interviews to be shown in court.
So the jury actually heard from Robert on a 6-foot screen, and they got to see him and feel his affect.
But the strange thing is, they weren't allowed to know Robert was dead. They weren't allowed to know why he was missing at all, because technically, it wasn't pertinent to the case. Whether or not he was alive didn't change the fact of what Leon Moore had or had not done to him, which seems strangely fitting, that the last people to get to know Robert, the jury, still didn't know quite everything. Up to the very end, there was always some big secret. Criminal is produced by Eric Mennel, Lauren Spohr, and me. Our artwork is by Julian Alexander. Special thanks to Carol Jackson and Katie Herzog. Our website is thisiscriminal.com, and that's where you can sign up for our newsletter or get in contact with us. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Criminal Show, and we have links to the Kickstarter in all of those places. Consider pitching in. It means a lot to us. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Criminal.
You're listening to The Spot, the show that features the best stories from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. In the previous story, Robert didn't have a choice to let Leon into his car that fateful day. But sometimes, life-changing moments can come from a proposition and the subsequent decision you make from it. In the historical podcast, The Memory Palace, Nate DeMayo tells the story of how a business exchange changed not only one man's life, but the entertainment world as he knew it.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMayo. Let's take a few minutes to remember the story of Joyce Heth. though there's so little we know of it. At least the parts that weren't made up. We'll start in Lower Manhattan in 1835, where there's a salesman working the front counter of a general store. He's 25 and bored, wishing he were doing something different, wishing he were living more, the usual. And in walks a man. Now, we don't know where this actually all went down, but to keep our story streamlined and dramatic, we'll just say it all happens right there in the store. So in walks a man named Corey Bartram, and he steps up to the counter and tells our bored young man that he's got a proposition for him, a business deal that will change the young man's life. And though neither man, of course, knows it at that moment right there in the store, it will wind up changing the world. Bartram tells the young man that down in Philadelphia, there's a show that he's just got to see. And the guy who runs the show is looking to sell. He's looking for someone to take it over for like $3,000. So, cut to Philadelphia. The two sit in the audience in a dingy little theater. And the show's pretty good. However, $3,000 is a lot of money in 1835, especially for a 25-year-old sales clerk with no experience at all in show business. But this is no ordinary sales clerk. He was born for this sort of thing. He's a natural. And he knows that there's incredible potential here, but he doesn't let on. He hems and haws about the price. He says he's just not sure, even though he's totally sure. And he talks the owner down to $1,000. Both men walk away feeling like he just got away with murder. Though from the twinkle we can see in the young man's eye, we know who's right about that. The young man is Phineas Taylor Barnum of Bethel, Connecticut. And his career as P.T. Barnum, world-famous showman, starts here with this $1,000. The show he bought that day was started by a man named R.W. Lindsay. Lindsay told the story about coming across an elderly slave who was living in an outhouse in a farm in Kentucky's Jefferson County. And he purchased the woman and then started inventing a different story. The woman's name was Joyce Heth. She was around 80 years old. Though nobody could really know for sure, probably not even her. And certainly no one else cared about how old a slave was. Unless, as Lindsay and later Barnum would claim, that slave happened to be 161 years old. This is the story that was concocted for Joyce Heth. 108 years earlier, when she was already 54 years old, she was bought by a Virginia farmer named Augustine Washington, who needed her to take care of his infant son, George Washington. And so when P.T. Barnum took over the show and brought Joyce Heth to Broadway, the people who lined up to buy tickets were not only paying to see a natural wonder of incredible age, of not at all credible age, they were also paying to see a living, breathing link to the much beloved and dearly departed father of their country. And Heth put on a good show. She looked the part. She was blind and partially paralyzed. Her owners hadn't cut her nails in years, so they curled and twisted, making her hands and feet look kind of like claws, the way a customer might suppose his own might look if he lived to be 161. And she acted the part. She told stories of bathing baby George, of seeing in her young charge flashes of brilliance and preternatural virtue that befit the great man he would later become. She was even there the day he chopped down the cherry tree, which was another story that was completely made up. Joyce Heth was a hit. Barnum was pulling in $1,500 a week in New York and later on tour. He could have made more money too, but he had to cut down the number of performances. It seemed Heth was easily exhausted, which was, he'd tell the press, to be expected from someone who was 161. But after a while, people started to doubt Barnum's story. 161 was really old, and ticket sales slumped. But Phineas Barnum, anonymous sales clerk, became P.T. Barnum, world-famous showman, for a reason. He came up with a new story. He started a rumor that the old story was a scam. That not only was Joyce Heth not a 160-year-old woman, she wasn't even a woman. She was a robot, a wind-up automaton made of leather and whalebone. And people bought tickets to see if that was true. And when Heth died in 1836, less than a year after Barnum had bought her and the story that came with her, he sold tickets to her autopsy and said there must be some sort of mistake when the doctor said she couldn't have been much more than 80. And thus ends the story of Joyce Heth. Barnum's, of course, continues. He goes on to fame and fortune. He changes the world. But that's it for her story. I wish there was more that I could tell you, but there isn't really. There are details I left out, of course, about which cities she visited on tour, about the hymns she sang during her performances, about the stories that she told of young George Washington. But not the things that I'd like to tell you. Not the things that I'd like to know. Because nobody wrote those things down. And probably no one ever bothered to ask. So I can't tell you how she actually came to be bought by R.W. Lindsay. Or how he came up with the Washington story. Or what she thought about that. Or why she went along with it. Or how it felt to be on display. Or perform every night. Or move from city to city. At 80 years old. Cities that she couldn't even see. I'd like to know what she and Barnum talked about in the idle hours between shows, or in the backs of horse-drawn wagons between cities. I'd like to know what she did in the 80 years before she was taken from that Kentucky farm. I'd like to know what work she did, and for whom she did it, before she did that strange work from Barnum telling stories about working for Washington. I'd like to know whether she was born in this country, or whether she was taken here, and from where was she taken, and from whom. I'd like to know who she loved, and whose story she could have told instead of the ones that someone made up about someone she'd never known. But I can't. I can take a few minutes to remember the story of Joyce Heth, when I'd rather take a few minutes to remember her.
That story was written and produced by Nate DeMayo for his podcast, The Memory Palace. If well-written, ethereal-sounding historical accounts are your thing, you can find many, many more at thememorypalace.us. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Just look at the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next week for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.